This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Batteries are everywhere in modern life. I was thinking through my morning today. I woke up to an alarm on my phone, powered by batteries. I listened to a podcast using AirPods, each of which has a teeny tiny battery inside. My car, which is a hybrid, has a huge battery. And as we transition to a greener future, batteries are only going to become more important. Wind energy and solar are still limited by calm days and the night. But if you have batteries, you can smooth out those interruptions in clean energy generation. Likewise, the future of electric cars will depend on better batteries. In 2008, you could buy the original Tesla Roadster sports car for the equivalent of more than $150,000 in today's dollars. That would carry you, at the time, an unprecedented 245 miles. Today's electric vehicles have seen some improvements in range and a dramatic decrease in price, but there's still a long way to go. And that's why, 10 years ago, the U.S. Department of Energy announced the creation of the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research. This was a multidisciplinary team that spanned institutions but was rooted here in Illinois at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont. At the time, some called it a battery moonshot, and the idea was to spur progress in making batteries that were more powerful, more efficient, and less expensive. A decade later, we thought we'd check in on how that's going. So joining me today is Dr. Venkat Srinivasan. He's Deputy Director for Research and Development at the Joint Centers for Energy Storage Research, or JCESR as it's known. He's also the head of the Argonne Collaborative Center for Energy Storage Science. Venkat, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
Also with us is Professor Paul Braun, Professor and Granger Distinguished Chair in Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's also Director of the Materials Research Laboratory there. Paul, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for including me.
And listeners, as ever, we want to invite you into our conversation. What questions do you have about battery technology? What changes have you seen in batteries in your lifetime? 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can always email us as well. Talk at 21stshow.org is the address. Again, talk at 21stshow.org. So, Paul, let me just start with you, and maybe we can start on a very basic level. As I sometimes say, if you can explain to me like I'm a smart 13-year-old, what exactly is a battery?
Sure. No, great pleasure. So a battery stores electrical energy via chemical reactions. So it's really a device that converts electrical input into a chemical reaction when you're charging, and then reverses that reaction when you're discharging. And so what you're really doing there is you're moving electricity or electrons through an outside circuit, and in that cell you have, you know, whether this is a D cell, meaning you buy it and discharge it once, or, you know, the most fancy rechargeable batteries today, there's chemical reactions going on inside. And there's two parts. There's a positive terminal and a negative terminal, and there's different reactions that occur at those two terminals. And then if we zoom in a little bit more and look at, say, a lithium ion battery, inside of the battery, we're moving lithium, and we're moving lithium between the positive and the negative. And when we're charging the battery, we're actually moving the lithium into the negative terminal, and we're converting it from an ion into a metal. And to do that, we move electrons. And when we discharge the battery, we're taking the lithium out, where it's sort of in a metallic-like form, and moving it over to the positive side, where it's now in an ionic form. And to convert it from this metal zero to be a positive charge species, that means we have to move electrons through the circuit. So that's basically what a battery is. It's a tiny little chemical storage element that can move between these two forms of energy that we're quite familiar with.
I'm chuckling to myself because you've now reminded me why I started as a physics major at the University of Illinois, but did not end up as a physics major at the University of Illinois. And it was, in fact, the chemistry. But Venkat Srinivasan, let me bring you into the conversation now. So we now have a sort of an understanding of what the basics of a battery is. Can you talk about the history of the development of battery technology? I mean, it strikes me just as a casual layperson that there were not necessarily huge leaps, at least that we consumers could see from like my childhood in the 1970s and 80s through, you know, I guess the turn of the century, right?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question, right? So it does actually, battery technology has been improving every year. It's been improving incrementally. So that's why there is a sense that maybe if you go, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, nothing much has changed, but in reality, it has been changing. So let's go back in time. It used to be that all of us were using lead acid batteries. These were batteries that you find in your car for starting. We still use that today for starting a car. Those batteries had reasonably decent energy density for the times 30, 40 years ago. But it turned out that there was no way to power an electric vehicle of any reasonable range using a lead-acid battery. We then, in the 1980s, started moving towards these nickel-cadmiums and these nickel-metal hydride batteries. But really, the revolution in battery technology has happened because of lithium-ion batteries in the 1990s. And by the time we get to the 2000s, it became clear that lithium-ion, because it had significantly higher energy density compared to the previous battery technologies, it's almost twice what you get from nickel cadmium and, you know, four times what you would get from a lead acid battery, you can start to use that to do some interesting things. So it's just example, right? The cell phones we are carrying today would not be possible if not for the lithium ion battery. Every other technology before lithium ion would be so big that you will not be able to carry that in your pocket or use a laptop in a sort of a fashion that we use it today, right? So that's the first thing. Now, lithium ion itself has been improving every year, right? The lithium ion in 1990s is not the same lithium ion we're using today. We've been making improvements in leaps and bounds. The catch is that every year it goes up by approximately 5, 10, maybe 6% at best. And so at any given time, it looks like things are moving slowly. But if you look at it from a decadal perspective, we're able to kind of move from a technology that looked interesting in the 1990s to something that has become, I think, largely sort of revolutionary, sort of pivotal when we look at 2022. And we can see this in the marketplace, right? We were talking about electric cars, and then in the mid-2000s, people used to make jokes about how these were like golf carts, had very little power, had very little range. Today, we have these amazing cars that can go 0 to 60 in 3 seconds, have ranges like you were mentioning, 250 miles, maybe 300 miles. And we can start to do some very interesting stuff. Still some challenges, and we should talk about that. But certainly we've come a long way, I think, compared to the battery technologies we've had in the 1970s, but even in the 1990s and 2000s.
Well, let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about battery technology and where it's going. There's an effort that's been ongoing for 10 years, rooted here in Illinois, though with people part of it across the country. It's called the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research. It's based at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont. We're speaking with the Deputy Director for Research and Development of that, Venkat Srinivasan, as well as Paul Braun, who's a professor and Director of the Materials Research Laboratory at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So, Venkat, I remember when we talked 10 years ago, I wrote a magazine story on this, and I think it was not you, but Eric Isaacs, who was director of Argonne, at least at the time, and laid out this 5-5-5 goal, right? You mentioned a few moments ago that, you know, batteries have been improving 5-10% per year. The idea there was a 500% leap, right, in the power, a 500% drop in the cost within 5 years. How has that gone?
Yeah, actually, things have gone remarkably well in battery technology in the last decade, right? So let's take a step back. The big thing that we wanted to do, right, from a societal perspective, was two things. We want to decarbonize the transportation sector, meaning every vehicle has to be an electric vehicle. Not just passenger cars. We hope in the future it'll also be things like heavy-duty trucks and rail and aviation. That's the first big challenge, is how do we make it cost-effective? The second one that you mentioned was the grid. How are we going to get to a state where we can have a predominantly renewable grid, but which is also stable so that we can deal with intermittency? So it turned out there were some interesting trends that were happening through the 2000s as we were kind of moving along in JCESR, this effort that you were talking about. First is, the R&D was getting better and better, right? So we are learning more about how to control materials. Paul told you about how important it is to move these ions back and forth. If you want low cost, the materials that you're going to be moving the ions back and forth then have to be extremely cheap. If you want to get long cycle life, you have to make sure that those ions move reversibly and don't sort of go do things that you don't want it to do. We were learning a lot in these programs about how to do that. Simultaneously, companies like Tesla were building these big factories, these gigafactories. It turned out that before the Teslas of the world started building these gigafactories, we thought the cost of manufacturing could not be beaten down any further. And it turned out that you can beat down the cost of manufacturing further, which meant that as these gigafactories came on board, cost of battery started coming down further and further, right? That's the second thing. And the third important thing that we've learned is that there is a certain maturity in the market where before the program started, we all thought that there was one battery that's going to rule everything. It's going to be this one battery, maybe a lithium ion, maybe a sort of an advanced technology that will be used to power your cars, but it'll also be used for the grid. What we've learned is that as the technology matures and the market matures, there is a need for us to have a diversity of different battery technologies for the many different applications that batteries are going to be used for. So the battery that you would use in an electric car is probably not the same as one you would use in your home if you have a solar panel. It won't be the same as the technology you might be using, let's say, if you want to do seasonal storage. So let's say you don't ever want to be on the electric grid. You want to have renewable electricity powering your home. In many cases, it's going to be bigger than just your home where you're going to be powering these things. The problem is that what happens if you have 1 week of cloudy days? How do you power your home then? So then you need 1 week of storage. Turns out that each of these applications is going to require a different technology. So one of the things that we started focusing on is how do we ensure that we can provide the marketplace with a diversity of technologies for this diversity of applications. But the end result of all of these changes that have been going on is that today we have electric cars that are still not completely cost effective, but are getting to the stage where more and more people can afford them. They give you the driving range we're looking for. There are still some challenges, but we can see that they're starting to enter the marketplace. Same thing is happening on the grid. More and more people, especially in places like California, where electricity is expensive, are starting to use solar for generation and batteries for storage. And they're finding out that that combination is getting them to be not completely cost-effective compared to grid electricity, but getting them close. And those are the big dramatic changes that have happened in the last decade.
Paul, I'd like you to pick up on something that Venkat was talking about there, which is different batteries for different purposes. Can you say more about why that would be the case?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, and as Venkat was saying, you know, when this all started, sort of the early research and the early batteries that you would get in the 1990s and sort of around the turn of the century, there was a very limited number of chemistries. You know, most of them were based on sort of carbon at the negative terminal and one very specific oxide material, a kind of ceramic, but a pretty expensive ceramic on the positive terminal. And, you know, that was fine for, you know, cell phones and for laptops. But now that we think about all of these different applications, and some of them are really sensitive to cost, others are going to be really sensitive to weight. Others might be really sensitive to the peak amount of energy they can produce, peak power. You know, others you might want to have that are really fast charging, but maybe you're less concerned about some of the other aspects. And so, you know, now we've started to learn that, you know, there may be chemistries that we really want to be low cost. So these are ideas that maybe use sulfur as one of the components. And so there's this community that really works on what's called a lithium sulfur battery, and maybe even some others. And you know, sulfur is really dirt cheap. You can find images from satellites of giant piles of sulfur. You know, it has some other challenges, but from a cost perspective, it's very competitive. You know, then there's some that may sit somewhere in the middle, some of the automotive, where, you know, the performance aspects still have to be there, but maybe aren't as critical from a weight standpoint as, say, a cell phone. And so here we're learning to use chemistries that contain more, say, iron or nickel or manganese, some materials that are medium cost. And so those are things that we're talking about on the positive side. And then on the negative terminal, again, we initially started with this one kind of a graphite chemistry. You know, now some people are working on, can we have it be pure metal there? And so there may be a lot of advantages. You'll hear things like a lithium metal battery. And that gives you a lot of advantages from weight and power, but there's some engineering challenges, and lithium still is somewhat costly. And then there's people thinking about using really low-cost materials. Imagine if we could use sodium. You know, table salt is sodium chloride. And so if we could use sodium, now the costs go down a lot. You know, but other challenges come in. And so what we now see is this whole family of different materials and chemistries that fit into different spaces in this power, energy, cycle life, cost, a landscape. And that's becoming really important because what you need to drive a semi is different than what you need to store energy for the grid, which is different than what you need for, you know, some of these future emerging applications like, you know, electrified aviation, where, you know, weight and volume and cost, it's a very different set of priorities for an electrified aircraft than it is for a semi or for the grid.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or what you would want to have in your basement, right? Which could conceivably weigh a lot more than what you would have in an aircraft.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to have to take a break in about a minute here. But just to sort of set up the rest of our conversation there, you know, obviously there are advances that you've been describing. What are some of the and Venkat, let me ask you, and again, maybe just 30 seconds to sort of tease where we can come back to. What are some of the you know, breakthroughs that you hope to see in the next 10 years?
A few things have to happen, I think, that are critical, and we should spend some time on it. One of the most important things we're worrying about today is the fact that we use nickel, cobalt in these batteries. These materials have a very complicated supply chain, and we are really, really concerned about how we're going to satisfy the requirements in the marketplace by using these metals. We have to think very hard about recycling. That's going to be an important challenge for us as we look to the future. So that's one aspect. Mm-hmm. The second one is, as we look to decarbonize the whole economy, to the point that Paul was making, we need to think beyond passenger cars. And as we look at these new applications, both in transportation and on the grid, that are going to be a need for us to invent a new class of materials and new batteries that have tremendously performance advances compared to the chemistries we're using today. And that's going to be a big challenge going into the future.
All right. And we will talk about those things. Great launching point for the next part of our conversation. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about batteries and how battery technology has improved in the past 10 years since Illinois became the launching pad, if you will, for a battery moonshot. It's called the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research, based at Argonne National Laboratory. The deputy director for research and development of that project is Dr. Venkat Srinivasan, who's also the head of the Argonne Collaborative Center for Energy Storage Science. Also with us today is Professor Paul Braun, who's the Granger Distinguished Chair in Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also Director of the Materials Research Laboratory there. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. That's 800-222-9455. And Venkat, I'm so glad you mentioned this idea of the supply chain, because one thing I did want to ask about, there have been a series of stories in the past few years. The New York Times has done a lot of work on this. Looking at the materials that go into batteries. One phrase that's really stood out in my mind is the idea of cobalt, which I guess is an essential ingredient, has been referred to as the blood diamond of batteries. So can you talk about the challenges that that presents for our green energy future?
Certainly. As you were mentioning, right, what has happened is that as we looked at the lithium-ion chemistry evolve, they've always, since the 1990s, used cobalt. So your cell phone actually has what is called lithium cobalt oxide. It's pretty much the only transition metal it uses is cobalt. The electric vehicle market is, you know, sort of changed. We knew cobalt was a problem, so we started adding nickel and manganese to substitute for the cobalt. So we use what is called nickel manganese cobalt oxide in our electric vehicles. Turns out, as you mentioned, cobalt comes from sort of complicated parts of the world. It's actually predominantly from the Democratic Republic of Congo. We have very little control over the supply chain of cobalt in the United States. What we are seeing, especially with the pandemic and the sort of the significant challenges we've had with supply chain all over, is that If you don't have control over the supply chain, you have very little control over the pricing of the materials and access to the materials. So just to tell you what's going on, after decades of the cost of lithium batteries coming down every year, 2022 will be the first year where the cost, 2023 will be the first year where the cost of lithium ion batteries is going to go up. And that's because of the cost of cobalt and now the cost of nickel. Nickel became an issue during the Ukraine war, where there were, for various reasons, the cost of nickel started going up. That means that the cost of these lithium, nickel, cobalt, manganese oxide cathodes started going up. This is a significant challenge. What we have to do is we have to start moving away from cobalt and nickel. So a big effort that is going on right now is trying to minimize the amount of cobalt and nickel in these batteries. But ultimately, my sense is we may have to get rid of both of them. Now, the cost of lithium has also been a challenge. It's been going up actually recently. You know, so we hope that it'll come down in the future. But the big message for me in all of these things is that it's important for us to diversify the kinds of materials we're using in batteries. If we are only dependent on a few metals and we start ramping up the demand for all the different applications, and it's not just demand in the US, the whole world is trying to decarbonize, we are going to find the supply crunch is going to be more and more the biggest challenge we'll face in order to move these technologies forward. The more we can find new materials for finding storing energy, the better chance we'll have to ensure that we're able to continue this march towards a decarbonized economy.
Paul, what about that? Paul Brown from the University of Illinois, is there some as yet unthought of combination of materials that you think will be the real breakthrough here? Or is it just going to be a refinement of what we already know? Where do you see this going?
You know, I'm always a real optimist in that we're going to come up with, you know, truly revolutionary new ideas. You know, the periodic table is broad. Every day we learn how to put together materials in sort of new and really different ways. You know, today's batteries primarily, for example, use a liquid electrolyte that sits between the positive and negative and the terminals, and the lithium moves through that. You know, there's some emerging work. Could we replace that with a solid? You know, right now that's just sort of the Wild West of different ideas. But
would that mean that my batteries don't leak into my recorder when I don't use it?
They won't leak. It's called a solid state battery. So this is just one of these areas that's emerging. But, you know, if we can come up with a new way to maybe change the liquid and replace that with a solid, now there's all sorts of materials we've thought about for the ceramic, where we currently have the cobalt or where we have the carbon on the anode. You know, maybe we can change them dramatically because some of that material selection was to make it work with the liquid. So that it's not maybe that we're just going to only change what we do at the cathode, the positive terminal. You know, it's not that we're just trying to get rid of cobalt and nickel and we'll keep everything else the same. But there could be some really transformational changes here. There's some very low cost materials that would be wonderful to use, you know, but they have, say, one shortcoming. And so, you know, if we could figure out how to address that one shortcoming, all of a sudden, an entirely new world of materials opens up that we can consider. And so, you know, this idea of solid state batteries, this idea of using, you know, metals as the anodes instead of adding in carbon, this idea of completely getting rid of some of the expensive transition metals, the nickel and the cobalt at the positive terminal. So I don't think this is just going to be a steady trend of incremental. You know, what we're going to see, I think, is that there are incremental, but then there are these transformational changes that allow us to bring in, you know, really new classes of materials and new ideas.
If I could quickly add something to what Paul said, I mean, really, you know, I think we are in a tremendous time where there'll be all sorts of innovations coming. And in the last 10 years, we've seen that happen in the material space. And as Paul was saying, the periodic table is vast and battery materials are combinations of those different elements that we're putting together. Sometimes you're finding molecules, right? These are organic molecules that you're going to put in different configurations and they'll give you some really compelling properties. We in the last 10 years have been, as a community, using computation to find ways to predict the kind of the properties of these materials. And that gives us a chance to do this much faster than we've done in the past, right? So instead of evolution in battery technology at 5% a year, maybe we'll start seeing this go at a faster pace. And because we're going to need a diversity of different battery technologies for these different applications, there is a need for us to think in that vast scale of discovery, right? We can't be doing linear discovery anymore. So I do think that as we look to the future, we are in a tremendous time where we're going to have all the innovations start to come into play and hopefully start to have an impact in the marketplace.
Venkat, you also mentioned recycling, and I've read that there's just not a critical mass of recycling and maybe just not enough, you know, sort of old electric car batteries to make a real go of this market. Talk about the challenges that poses as well.
There are two things that come to when it comes to recycling, right? The first is exactly what you said. Even though it's extremely important for us to recycle when we finish end of life, we just don't have enough of those batteries out there in the field. Having said that, all of us probably have a few cell phones and a couple of laptops hanging somewhere in our offices and our desk drawers, which we don't know what to do with. Those batteries actually have a lot of cobalt in them. And it's something that we need to be finding a way to collect. So collection of batteries that are in homes and in businesses is a big part of the challenge. The next part of the challenge is trying to figure out how to cost effectively remove the elements that we want, but also to not just get rid of the other stuff that is not kind of economical, right? So for example, can we remove the lithium cost effectively? Can we make sure that we don't throw anything into the ground? All of that is going to be a big challenge when it comes to recycling. Right now, what's happening is that there's a big effort to try to push the recycling with new technologies, and those technologies have to get cost effective. They ultimately have to remove all the elements from the battery. This is a big effort that's actually going on at Argonne. We have a center at Argonne called Recell focused on recycling, where we're working with multiple partners. There are many companies also trying to do exactly this. Our hope is that as these technologies start developing, as we are able to make them more cost effective, as we find ways to kind of collect the batteries from these different applications, we will start to get to a state where we have the technology ready. And as these batteries start entering the end of life, we'll be able to recycle them and bring them back into the marketplace. But the reality is going to be that to satisfy the supply requirements, it's going to take us 10 plus years, right? So a typical electric car may last 10 years before it gets to the end of life. Hopefully it lasts even longer. So we should be thinking decadal when it comes to using recycling as an effective way to kind of meet our demand. But frankly, in the meantime, whatever we can recycle can be very important. The last thing I'll say about recycling is that one of the things that's happening in the United States is that there is this big push to build factories in the US. Just the announcements that you've been seeing every week of these gigafactories has been tremendous. It's actually outpaced all the estimates that we've been coming up with. When you build a new factory, you typically have what is called scrap, meaning that all the material that you're putting in don't become final batteries. You have wastes at various times. Those wastes can be collected and they can be recycled and put back in the supply chain. So I do think recycling is one of the most important technological breakthroughs that we have to push for in the next decade.
Yeah, I have a jar that I keep old batteries in, and then every, I don't know, a couple times a year, there's a shop in town that just sells batteries, and they claim to recycle them. I don't actually know what happens once I drop them off there, but I do try and drop them off. We have just a few minutes remaining in our conversation. I guess I want to ask you both, what sort of major life changes do you see being made possible by a major improvement in batteries? And I mean, this could be a small thing, right? I had a smartwatch, an Apple Watch. I recently stopped wearing it because, you know, after a couple of years, the battery just wouldn't even last a full day, and I need a watch to tell time. It's kind of important in my line of work. So what are some of the major life changes you think will be possible through batteries? And Venkat, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I'm such a battery advocate that I feel like all sorts of things will happen. I think batteries are going to be everywhere. We'll be talking about harnessing energy from different parts of, sort of things may be happening in the environment and then using that to store it into a battery. Part of this is my hope, and I think it's because I'm such a sort of enthusiast about batteries. In the next 10 to 20 years, we'll be seeing transportation become completely, electric, I think. And batteries are going to play a huge role in that. I also think what's going to happen, and this is really a dream, I think, for many of us in the battery community, is that batteries will never fall apart. So imagine a battery that you can give to your children, and hopefully, they can take it and become sort of an inheritance for them. So you can be using batteries that can last 20, 30 years, where these things are just churning and kind of giving you all the energy requirements you're looking for without falling apart. I think those days are going to come, right? We are learning more and more about how to control battery reactions, where we can get, instead of 10 years of life, something that can go to 30, 40 years of life. And I really hope that day comes where we can start using the battery in terms of not just as something that is dispersible that gets thrown away, like you've been doing, but something that will last such a long time that it becomes an asset for us and we give it off to our children and our hopefully our grandchildren one day. So
That's amazing. Paul, same question to you. And
yeah,
about
you know, I
two
think
minutes,
Ben-Cat hit really hit the high points. I mean, the transportation ranging from, you know, personal vehicle to aviation to heavy trucks, you know, it's the way that can interplay with the grid where, you know, as again, if the batteries now have a very long life, then they can be charged and discharged sort of infinitely. You know, you just end up with this system where, you know, the grid can feed the vehicles can feed the grid. You know, we get rid of all of these industrial pollutants, particularly that are in more urban areas, because we don't have, you know, heavy trucks idling on the streets. You know, the changes that will occur to aviation when, you know, jet fuel is not a dominant cost and a dominant polluter. You know, it's not just going to be one thing. You know, the world's going to look really different because of our ability to store energy.
Paul Braun is professor and Granger Distinguished Chair in Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Dr. Venkat Srinivasan is Deputy Director for Research and Development at the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research at Argonne National Lab. Thank you both so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. Coming up on Monday, we're going to be marking Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We're going to have a conversation about a new PBS documentary. It's on the Independent Lens series about that includes a discussion of the reparations, so-called reparations program in Evanston, Illinois. Plus, we'll be revisiting my conversation with Don Rose, who was press secretary to Dr. King during his anti-poverty campaign in Chicago in the 1960s. That's all coming up Monday on the 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Anaya Jones, and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. We'd love to hear what you thought about today's program, and we welcome suggestions for future conversations. You can send us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. talk@21stshow.org. You can also find that address, plus every other way to contact us, on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.